story you're about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Good evening. You are listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. Or if you're listening to us on satellite, virtual channel W3957. On channel 46, Trust Cable in Alabama. Kickradio.com or wherever you can pick us up. It's great to have you tonight. Here on the Dana Pretzer Show, author Fred Rosen. He has a new book out called There But For the Grace of God. And then my go-to media guy, Eric Spinato, will be here to talk about some media news stories that have his attention. And then Cheyenne Jackson will be here to talk about her missing brother, Cole Jackson. And in a few minutes, we're going to have some breaking news out of the world of rock and roll history. That's here tonight on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Now we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. This is breaking news coming out of the world of legendary rock and roll history. In fact, I don't even think you've seen this on TMZ.com yet, so we're glad to have this story breaking on my show this evening. Wade Jones, if you remember back a while ago, was on my show talking about the Elvis Cup. He's the Elvis Cup guy, and he's got breaking news. Hi, Wade.
Hey, man, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Welcome back to the program.
Good to talk to you.
I'm seeing that the Elvis Cup is going to be leaving the building here. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I tell you what, it's been really a lot of pressure on me in the past 2 years, touring with the Elvis Cup.
Yeah.
Making public appearances, the paparazzi, just the constant media pressure on me. And I decided that, I was going to kind of cut loose from it at some point. And I figured that August 16th, 2007, 30th anniversary of Elvis' death, would be a good time to kind of break free and just kind of retire the Elvis Cup.
30 years, that's been a long time since Elvis passed away. And I know I'd be shocked if someone come forward and said they didn't know who I was interviewing tonight, but tell them a little bit about the Elvis Cup and how you came about to get it.
Well, I was 13 years old, and I found out that Elvis was going to be performing at the Charlotte Coliseum here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And it was my birthday, and I told my parents that I wanted to see Elvis for my birthday, so they went and sent off for tickets, and sure enough, I got to go to Elvis's last concert here in North Carolina, and it was a 6 months after the concert that I went to that he died. And after the concert, I went to the stage and managed to get a policeman to hand me the cup that Elvis had been drinking out of while he introduced his band. And to make a long story short, I sold the little bit of water that was that had remained from Elvis's cup on eBay for $455. It was about 3 tablespoons of water. And then the week after that, I sold an appearance of Elvis's cup on eBay for $3,000. And I flew out to Colorado and toured with it. And that kind of started off the whole Elvis cup tour situation that I found myself in. And since then, I've toured around the country with the cup. I've teamed up with a Filipino Elvis impersonator who actually wrote a song about the Elvis Cup, and it's on his latest CD. And it's just the grueling concert schedule that we've been going through, and like I said, the media and the damn press is hounding me to death. And my family, it's just too much for me to take.
I can understand the pressure, and Lindsay Lohan and all that sort of stuff is one thing, but the Elvis Cup.
Oh yeah, I can't even go to a 7-Eleven or Circle K without people on my tail.
Oh no!
And they're following me. They're taking pictures of me. They're writing stuff about me, and I just can't take it. No. I mean, I really, this is exclusive to your show,
right? There isn't
been rehab about a month ago.
Oh, I was just about
for all
to,
the crap that's gone down.
I was just about to ask that. Was there a rehab situation going on here, Wade?
Yeah, hell yeah. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to curse on your show here.
That's okay.
But I was addicted to, a lot of people call it hillbilly heroin.
Right.
But, I've kind of gotten through that, and I've tried to lay low. But the Elvis Cup, I love it and I hate it.
Yeah. It's somewhat like Elvis's life. Everyone loved Elvis, but I think at times Elvis hated his life.
Yeah. Well, Elvis was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
And I feel that Elvis was like the Messiah. For Elvis to live, he had to die.
Absolutely. And
there could not be a 72-year-old Elvis.
No. No, it's just not right.
No, and I feel that he died for our sins, of course, and I feel that he, 400 years from now, he's going to make a huge impact on everyone's life, and I just hope. And I'm not kidding. I hope whoever owns this cup can handle
the pressure
that they will be under.
Now, there's the Elvis Cup will be appearing in a feature motion picture soon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I've got a Hollywood director. His name is Glenn Greffey, G-R-E-F-E, and he's done a couple of real low-budget horror flicks. And he's...
Just a minute. We have to clarify something, Wade. Hang on. That's horror flicks, right?
Yeah, horror.
H-O-R-R-O-R.
Like blood and guts,
right.
That type of thing.
All right.
And he's kind of experimented with the Elvis Cup and myself and Renelvis, who is the Filipino spawn of Elvis. And for your listeners that don't know, you can go to www.elviscup.com and see pictures of the Elvis Cup, myself and Renelvis, the Filipino spawn of Elvis. And he's a 61-year-old Elvis impersonator who channels Elvis's thoughts and feelings and his spirit. And Glenn Greffey, the Hollywood producer, is working on a feature motion picture, which, of course, is like a B-grade motion picture that'll go directly to DVD. But he's working on a feature film featuring the Elvis Cup and Renelvis and myself, in which the Elvis Cup is stolen, and evil forces are trying to get it and use its powers for evil, but we get it back.
Wow. That sounds like a spellbinder for sure. Wade, thank you for coming on. I hope your rehab worked and you're able to get some peace in your life, because those paparazzi have destroyed many a fine person, and I don't want you to be one of them.
Well, they have, and like I said, please have your listeners check out elviscup.com, and you can contact me there through the website. Also, I plan a huge farewell exhibit of the Elvis Cup on August 16th, 2007, which will mark the 30th anniversary of Elvis's death. And after that, the Elvis Cup is shut down. It will never be shown again.
All right. Wade Jones, the Elvis Cup guy, thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, buddy.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Wow. We thought we'd start with that tonight. Yeah, those paparazzi, they can be tough, even on the Elvis Cup guy. Hi, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys. When you hear the names David Berkowitz, Bobby Joe Long, Richard Speck, Ted Bundy, Dennis the BTK Raider, Derek Todd Lee, Jeffrey Dahmer, it makes you wonder and makes you scared a little bit. It doesn't me. In my 25 years of law enforcement, I've really grown to be fascinated with some of these serial killer cases. There's a new book out called There But For the Grace of God, Survivors of the 20th Century's Infamous Serial Killers. The author, Fred Rosen, is a former columnist for the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times and is now one of the leading true crime authors in the United States. His 12 published works in the genre include the true crime classic Lobster Boy. In that case, Mr. Rosen's detective work that led to the conviction of the killer. His true crime blog is fredrosen.com, and it's an honor to have Fred Rosen with us this evening. Hi, Fred.
Hi there, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. You know, there but for the grace of God, when you hear the title or see the title, it makes you wonder about it. Before we get into the book, how did you come up with that title? I love it, by the way.
Thank you. You know, this is one of those times where the author has to be totally truthful and say, I wasn't the one that came up with that title.
Okay.
What happened was, the real story is that a couple of years ago, I decided I was going to start listening to people who were putting money in my pocket and made sense. One of those people was my agent, and she also happened to be an author, and she was just great with titles. So, you know, I happened to be talking one day about something about, there but for the grace of God regarding some book I was writing, and she said, that's a great title. And right there she started to formulate the idea of talking to survivors, because she knew that I was at a point where I was sick and tired of just doing traditional true crime, and I needed to do something for my soul, something more positive, but still in that same genre. And so it sort of took off from there.
When you talk about serial killers from the police perspective or a homicide investigation, one would say that it's good police work that puts the case together, but in a lot of the cases, it's a victim, a survivor, a witness that is able to finally put the nail in the coffin, so to speak. And a lot of these cases, you don't hear about who put the BTK killer away. I know he wanted to get put away himself. One of Ted Bundy's victims that actually survived. That's the part that's fascinating here. When we think about Ted Bundy, we think about all the people that he killed, not the people that survived him. Let's start about the premise of the book and how you came about to write it.
Okay. The premise of the book was that, for change, I wanted to do a spin on the traditional true crime book, which really tells the story more from the point of view of either the detective end or the killer.
Right.
And that's traditional true crime writing. And I decided that I wanted to do something where we told the story from the point of view of the victim. The problem was not so much locating people. That actually, you know, I knew how to do that from being a reporter who has, you know, certainly similar, you know, skills to, you know, a police officer or like yourself.
Right.
It was, how do you connect the whole thing? You know, how do you go from like one chapter to another, and, you know, one part of the country to another, talking to different survivors, and there's a connection, and really they supplied it. I mean, while we had that title, There But For the Grace of God, every single one of these survivors began to talk about how God intervened to help them in one way or the other. And so they really provided that connecting tissue. And then I realized that in order for this thing to work, I needed to be more vulnerable with the reader than I have ever been. And so I opened up at the very beginning about what my belief system was and followed that through all the way through the book, so that there was a little bit of connecting tissue there as well.
If we could, before we get into the actual book itself, let's talk about media reporting and the I think you know where I'm going with this.
I'm sorry.
And the serial killer, most recently BTK was very prevalent in the news. And the old adage, if it bleeds, it leads. Many of us sat and watched in fascination, or maybe with our jaws open, when we heard Dennis Rader reenacting his crime and his own sick, twisted way. Let's talk about how the media has covered these cases in the past.
Well, they've covered these cases in the past in a way that's deified the serial killer.
Yep.
And that was one of the through lines that I used in the book, which is that I really wanted to blow that whole serial killer as Hannibal Lecter, brilliant guy, Anthony Hopkins, Academy Award winning guy who drinks Chianti, blah, blah, blah. I want to blow that whole idea to hell and make it clear that, first off, if I'm writing about these guys, they can't be very good,
right?
Because they've been caught.
Yeah,
some
exactly.
of them are dead.
Yeah.
So let's start with that. And the second thing is that I wanted people to see how the media, in the past, has taken people like Dennis Rader, for instance, and made them into killing machines. You know, this kind of garbage is what I'm talking about.
Yep.
And I'm very critical, actually, I think, in the book of coverage.
And,
particularly in CNN, I might add.
And rightfully so. And rightfully
thank,
so.
Thank you, because I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about it?
Well, you know, and I'm going to talk from both perspectives, both as a touch.
I want to hear from your perspective as a police officer.
Okay, and I'll do both. As a police officer, there's nothing that drives me more crazy, okay, than media coverage that is strictly there to entice and solicit ratings, but to misinform the public. I bite my bottom lip every time I see a case covered, cases I have investigated where the media comes forward, almost tries to glamorize the situation, almost tries to make more of what it actually is than some crazy sociopath that has gone out and taken someone's life. I look at and this is a strange analogy, but I look at even a cartoon like The Simpsons that my son watched here the other day, where even they made fun of, I think it was Milhouse's dad who was in jail, and everybody was worried about Milhouse's dad, and Chief Wiggum comes forward and says, "What are you talking about? These kind of guys, thanks to the media, will have the babes all over them." And then looking out the window is Milhouse's dad and all the women standing out there screaming and yelling for him. And I look and see how the media has misinterpreted, misreported, and gone ahead and glamorized these cases somewhat to only their benefit and not the benefit of the victim, or to try and help the victim. And that's what I try to do differently on my program. I'm here to help the victim and tell their story.
Well, I think that's just incredibly eloquent. I mean, I couldn't agree with what you've said more in terms of how the media covers this stuff. And and I understand, you know, I understand the necessity to fill the time, especially with cable. But I deplore the poor reporting that takes place.
Yep.
Because it makes my job that much more difficult. I mean, I can tell you this, Dana. 10 years ago, when I was investigating whatever murder I was, nobody that I was talking to was asking me for money for an interview. Nobody. Today, more than half of the people I'll talk to who are not in law enforcement or in, well, actually, that's not true. I was going to say I just did a story, a book where one of the prosecutors involved in the case essentially asked me for a cut up front to be a part of the book.
Wow.
And I turned him down.
Wow. And just the ethic.
And so yeah. It's gotten to the point where it seems like everybody's hand is out and people won't talk to you unless you give them money.
Yep. And that's the ethical issues just make my stomach churn. We look at the Duke lacrosse scandal and what happened to the DA there. He was starstruck and it ended up biting him in the butt. Let's get to the book.
Okay.
When I think of Mark Harmon, I think of him portraying Ted Bundy.
Thank you for saying that. I think the same thing.
Yeah, and that's about it for Mark Harmon, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
I know he's done done some TV.
Got that iciness about this guy.
Oh, yeah. Scares the hell out of you when you watch him. But Ted Bundy was caught partially because of one of the survivors, Nita Neary. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Let's talk about your interview with her.
Sure. Well, first of all, I was very happy to hear you at the beginning talk about how even an experienced police officer like yourself would get, I don't know if fearful is the right word, or scared when dealing with this kind of individual, because even though Bundy is obviously long dead, he was the only one in this whole thing that spooked me out.
Yeah,
to be honest with you, the level, and I realized later on it was because of the level of the evil. It was just the level of the evil was it just reached out like tentacles. And so with Nita Neary, that it was the most difficult interview, because Nita Neary is the person who was in the sorority house in Florida.
Yeah.
Where Bundy went after he escaped jail from Denver. And he got into the sorority house. He killed two women. He maimed two others. And as he came down the stairs, through a set of various circumstances described in the book, Nita is able to ID him in such a way that he doesn't see her. However, what subsequently happens, and here we go, back to the media, is that Bundy escaped that night.
Yeah.
And this is what's fascinating. I don't know if you remembered this, because I didn't. Did you know that Bundy escaped from that night, from when he killed those women in Florida?
No.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And because you know what? And it may even be because the TV movie, which has become sort of the popular reference,
right,
may gloss over this. But what happens is he kills the two women. He escapes. He kills another woman. Neva Neary goes back to her home, and our friends in the media publish her address,
yeah,
with an escaped serial killer, the most infamous of modern times, still at large.
Yeah, just sickening.
So can you imagine, there I am talking to this woman, and I'm the first person she's talked to since then, because she hasn't trusted anybody in the media. Why should she?
I don't blame her.
You know, but I have to tell you that what's fascinating is that even though she's the only person in the book who didn't come in physical contact with the bad guy, her psychic wound, certainly compared to any physical wound that other individuals had, and the kind of, I'm going to say, patriotism that she shows in going on the stand and identifying this guy is really unusual. You know, she really lived up to the standards of both of our countries, you know what I mean?
Yep.
In being a citizen and identifying such an evil individual who eventually put him in the electric chair.
Absolutely. And, you know, the glamorization of Bundy, both in the media and in the movie, not so much in the movie, but more in the media, and this good-looking Republican, he spoke...
Oh, isn't that fascinating?
Spoke well, yet... we can get into that in a minute, too, but who spoke well, who represented himself, but...
Had a bachelor's degree.
Had a bachelor's degree, but yet even in death, and I've seen his autopsy photos, had that scary stare in his eyes, like he's looking at you and saying, I'm not done yet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I've seen some of those photos, and, you know, Ted Bundy is the only... I am not a capital punishment guy. I don't like it for all kinds of reasons.
Right.
But what's interesting to me about Bundy is... as far as I know, this is an historic first in criminal history. When he escaped the second time, he was already a convicted serial killer.
Right.
So now, here's my question. As a society, all right, we got a guy or gal, makes no difference, convicted of this crime, beyond a shadow of a doubt, escapes. And you know that this is, a sociopath. This is a guy from Mars.
Yep.
Why don't they put out the shoot to kill order?
Absolutely.
Okay? I mean, why don't we as a society change our perception of serial killers and look at them as the feral animals that they are and say, look, if you do this, okay, you're subject to the laws of whatever state or province you're in. But if you get out of our custody, you're dead.
Yep.
That's it. You're not coming back alive.
Yep.
Because you are a threat to society, and you've proven this beyond any shadow of a doubt. And I might add, I'm a registered Democrat. Okay?
Yeah, all right. No,
what does that translate into in Canada, registered Democrat?
Well, the Liberal Party.
And who's in office right now?
It's the Conservative Party. How do you like that?
Oh, gee, what a coincidence.
There you go.
Our president.
There you go. Well, that's another interview for another time.
Let's
go from the persona of Ted Bundy to the schlomp cop, Dennis Rader,
Sorry, you said that extremely well.
Thank you. Who teased law enforcement for many years, who, in my opinion, wanted to get caught, who, in my opinion, got off on himself so many times when he did his oration in front of the judge. We have Kevin Bright, someone who is, and I've read your book, by the way, and again, it's excellent.
Thank you very much.
We'll get in on how to get it here in a little while, who is as courageous as a person as you're going to speak to. Let's talk about Dennis Rader and Kevin Bright.
Well, I thank you for saying that very much. One of the things I'm finding as I talk to people is those who have been kind enough to take the time as yourself and read the book, you really come up with really interesting stuff. And Kevin Bright's case is, and BTK is off the charts in some ways.
Yep.
It's really off the charts, and I've thought about it a lot. And just to summarize, he's the only survivor of BTK, Dennis Rader. And Mr. Rader shot him twice. He strangled him, tried to suffocate him. And through the grace of God, and I'm giving a little bit away here, but that's okay. Kevin Bright, who weighs 145 pounds, maybe soaking wet, and was like maybe 5'8", hits Rader with a right uppercut worthy of Roberto Duran and takes Rader to his knees. This with two, while he's got bullets in him and the whole deal.
Right.
He then takes the opportunity to run out the door and escape, thank God.
Yep.
What's fascinating is how after all those years, when Rader made his declaration before the judge, it really rankled them that Bright survived.
Yep.
And so I decided when I wrote the book that I was going to do the best I could to show Rader for what he was, which is a schlumpy... By the way, another guy with a bachelor's degree, I might add,
yep.
which blows to heck the stereotype of the uneducated serial killer. But in any case, I wanted him to be angry. I was hoping he'd read the book, you know, and say, God, you know, this guy Rosen, he really gave me the business here. You know, I want to get him angry.
Right.
It's very childish, very juvenile. But the thing is, Bright survived, and it really rankled him. And it rankled him when he gave his declaration before this judge.
Yep, and he portrayed Bright as this big guy.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, and it's just amazing. It's that again, that sociopath with that arrogance about him. That you know, if I'd have brought my kit, he wouldn't be alive today.
That's what he said. If I brought my kit, and then he has to explain to the judge what his kit is like. Like, you know, it's some sort of, like, it's the Wild Wild West, and he's, you know, and he's James West, and he's got some sort of gadgets. Well, all he had was a bag with some rope, maybe, you know, and some other garbage, and, you know, he was a forensically aware serial killer.
Yep.
Very, very clear about that.
Yep.
And so he would, you know, he would come with some, you know, whatever junk he needed in order to kill people, but he was a coward. Bottom line, he's a coward. All these guys are cowards. I think that's a point we should make, shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. They're all
cowards.
Yep.
I mean, this is not a situation where somebody, you know, it's not high noon with two guys in the middle of the street and they each have guns. These guys, they kill, you know, they'll kill whoever they want to kill to you know, for their own kicks.
Yep. And to get off on it, that's for sure. Let's talk a little bit, Fred, about the law enforcement perspective of your book and how sometimes law enforcement is made to, and rightfully so. Yes, I am a law enforcement officer, but I will also admit that law enforcement in these cases sometimes become and show their arrogance and show their, you get the profiler that says it has to be ABC, and the small town cop that comes forward and says, no, it's W, and they say, no, get lost. There's that competition, that arrogance and that competitiveness between law enforcement agencies that basically make them screw up on some of these cases. Your thoughts?
It's the same in Canada, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you know, the thing is, that's so eloquent, again. And the arrogance, to me, the arrogance starts in the United States from the top, and that is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And I'm one of those individuals who grew up in the 1960s, and I watched this TV show called The FBI with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.
Yes.
I really thought that was it. I thought these guys were like, you know, real super duper cops, and then you become an adult and you find out otherwise. And the bottom line is this, and I point this out in the book, which is this, that the FBI's behavioral sciences division, or whatever they call it now, is a bunch of garbage. It's based upon a specious study that the FBI did in the late 70s of serial killers, some of whom weren't even serial killers. And it's one of those parts of the federal bureaucracy that justifies itself. And unfortunately, they have become the authority as a result of, you know, being glamorized in Silence of the Lambs on serial killers. And so local law enforcement will be sometimes forced to listen to these idiots who claim to be profilers. And I think we both know what a bunch of garbage that is.
Yeah. You know,
so what I discovered is that there are cases where you do have, like in the case in Florida, in the case of Bobby Joe Long, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department did a wonderful job in tracking this guy down. I mean, they did a really, you know, but those cases, I must admit, are few and far between.
And I'm going to call it a black eye, because it is a black eye for law enforcement, and it's about time, and we've covered different stories on my show over the years, that law enforcement puts their egos in their back pockets and starts to investigate crimes, what we say, law enforcement 101. Okay, and I do appreciate you joining me, Fred. That's Fred Rosen, author of the new book, There But For the Grace of God, Survivors of the 20th Century's Infamous Serial Killers. Thank you, sir, and we'll do this again real soon.
Thank you so much. It's available at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and FredRosen.com. Thank you, Dana.
And I recommend it. Thanks, Fred. And that's Fred Rosen. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Hi, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer, and of course we call this the Dana Pretzer Show. In our segment tonight on stories that make you scratch your head and wonder what the heck's going on, we bring on my media guy, Eric Spinato. He's the president of and CEO of Spinato Associates Corporation. There's a university president that's been fired after a murder cover-up. Yep, you heard it right. A university president's fired after a murder cover-up. And this is a story that we're seeing in the media a lot today. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm doing good. This is quite a story. Let's get into this.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Apparently, there was a woman that went to Eastern Michigan University. That body was found, I believe it was December 15th. Yeah, December 15th in a dorm room. And apparently, the president chose to tell family members and other people that they believe she died of suffocation, when in fact it was a foul play, and she was murdered. And now it all came to light over the weekend, where he was fired, and it all came down to the president was trying to protect the image of the university rather than doing what he should have done and disclose some information he knew, you know, firsthand when they found her body.
And not only will he have been fired, but I'm sure that he's being looked at for some criminal prosecution. What have you heard?
I haven't heard anything. But I will tell you one thing. I mean, he just opened up the school for a major liability where the family could turn around and sue civilly against the school. But apparently I do know that the board members are looking at possible other people that could be held accountable, because I believe, you know, it goes from public relations down, vice president of the university. I believe, you know, you might see other people might be released to their jobs too.
This is a big case, obviously, but the one that comes to mind before this is Duke. Public relations nightmare for them, and they went after the boys right away. This is a case now where a young girl passes away. The president is trying to, like you say, save the image of the school and try and keep enrollment up. What's going on with these schools?
I'll tell you, over the years I've been a journalist, I've come across numerous stories like this where, you know, universities, when a crime happens, most cases I would say rape, they don't like to reveal those type of incidents and or release records of the amount of criminal complaints that's been happened. You know, criminal, not so much complaints, but criminal activities that have taken place on any colleges, not just Ivy League colleges, but lower level colleges. Because again, it's just the PR, the image of the college wants to be known to come here for their education. But, you know, stuff does happen. Even the universities that have great security on patrol, you know, things do happen. It's just something that I've, you know, it's not uncommon that I get to read this occasionally throughout my 20 years as a journalist.
The body of Laura Dickinson, 22, was discovered on December 15th, like we said, in her dorm room. University officials told Dickinson's parents and the media that she died of asphyxiation, but there was no sign of foul play. Is that the place of the university to even be making a release like that, or should that have been law enforcement?
Well, the first thing they would do is go to law enforcement. I mean, if they have knowledge of this, two things usually will happen. I mean, usually a university might hear about it, and then the cops will ask them, to please be quiet, because as a police officer, until investigation is thorough, let's not do anything. At the same time, sometimes universities have their own police that take these matters in their own hands. And if they come across something, you can allude, make an allegation that maybe, they were told to be quiet. And then you lose days. As 48 hours are usually very important in crime scenes. And in this case, it just seems that, maybe something could have been prevented. Not so much prevented, but look, this guy was caught. The good news is the guy was caught. But had this gentleman, possibly committed other acts, criminal acts, that's where, people, the average parents or children, students have a right to be mad at the university, because basically their safety was possibly jeopardized.
Let's talk about that aspect of being in the media, a investigative reporter covering the case, and you're asked by the police to sit on a story. Now, there's no obligation for you, but you're asked to. Where do you draw the line between what your story brings and what the police are asking you to do?
Well, I think every journalist wants to always advance a story. I mean, I report an accurate story, but also advance the story. At the same time, crime beat reporters for most newspapers or local TV stations like to have a good rapport with these police officers. So if something is told not to, report it, I think a journalist has to weigh how important is this information, what are they actually holding back, if it's possibly, in this case, let's just role play. If a murder happens and a journalist knows it, I think it's a journalist's right to come forward, because it's a murder. It's not, like a pickpocket incident. And, and God forbid something does happen and a journalist knows it, he or she is going to possibly be held, accountable for this if this person ever committed, a future act that you knew about. So, it's important to have a relationship with police officers, but also very careful what you report, because you also don't want to jeopardize an ongoing investigation.
On that line, Eric, the reporter is trying to get their story. We've all seen in the press here recently about reporters that take it to the extreme, in fact, go and swim with one of the suspects in a disappearance. Where do you ethically draw that line as far as how you get your story?
I think she explained it. This is Ms. Jacobson, I think you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think she, just very bad judgment.
Yes, that's true.
I don't know how close, how many parents were there, it doesn't matter. She's a journalist. The difference between her and the other parents that were there at Stubbick's house, the suspect now in the murder of his wife, she's a journalist. So there's a difference there. A journalist that is covering a story. So she definitely made bad judgment. And of course, she blames the video camera. If it wasn't for the video camera, I have to disagree. I think, yes, it didn't look good visually, but I think if word got out that she was in the home, I still think she would have, been relieved of her duty as a reporter for the station.
Do you think she was set up?
No, I don't think she was set up.
No, that's gone around.
I don't think. Yeah. I mean, you could think about that, but I think in the bottom line, she shouldn't have been at the home. You know, in this type of position, I think.
Everyone.
And so you disclose it. You disclose it, and if I'm correct, she was feeding information to the police, but her station did not know this. So she was, you know, kind of not. You know, you really report to the news department first and police second. So I, you know, who's to say that she wasn't lying about other things? You understand what I mean? She was leading the people that she was working for.
Exactly. But then coming from the police perspective, which I can do here, if a reporter wants to go and gather some information for me, I'm going to take advantage of that and get that reporter to do what they can. Now, is there a danger aspect involved? Yes. But I guess that reporter has to make the judgment as far as what's more important to them and the possibility that they may lose their job over it.
You know, at that point in time, sometimes you don't. I mean, it's not like she snuck up at night, you know, looking through his window to see what he's doing. It was a friendly atmosphere, I'm sure. You know, like I said, she had her children. She was with other parents. It wasn't just her solo. But again, you know, it's unfortunately the public perception. You're in a suspect's house. You're in a bikini. You're a woman.
Yeah.
And you're a reporter. It's just, unfortunately, this doesn't paint a good picture to the average viewer or probably among your own colleagues at work. So, therefore, you know, what do you do if you know, the station could look really bad saying, oh, well, she made a bad judgment. Which they could have said this to buy her. But I believe that, you know, I'm sure, you know, I don't know the full story. I'm sure they looked into this and felt this was the best matter because they don't need a bunch of people, which is their viewers, their newscast viewers, to go away to another competing station in protest.
If we get back to the university story here for a minute, we talk about the Duke University and this Michigan University and others. What can these universities do, Eric, to try and get back their credibility, so to speak? Because it's all dollars and cents. Universities are providing education, of course, but without the support and the money and the students, they're not going to be much of anything. What can they do to smarten things up?
I just think, be honest with the public.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great university, just like many other colleges. When something bad happens, it happens. I mean, crime happens everywhere, no place that you would never imagine. If there was a trend, you know, all of a sudden it's, you know, three murders in 1 year, then you start to think, okay, what type of security is going on the campus? But you shouldn't blame a campus for someone taking a life, you know, or any type of crime that an individual chooses to do. So, you know, it's just be forward. It be sympathetic to the families. You know, if there's any weak points that you could do, if it's a security, if it's surveillance systems, I mean, that's the best you can do as a university is try to, you know, have secure, make the students feel safe and to further education. But when you know, don't disclose information that is very important, especially in this case, this was, you know, a murder. And even if it wasn't a murder, it was a man or woman, but in this case it was a woman's body found, you got to be forthcoming. I don't know what they thought by hiding this would really, you know, that eventually this would be left, you know, leaked out somehow. You know what I mean?
Right. No, exactly. Before I let you go, I want to talk to you a little bit about this Palm Beach County tourism chief story. It's a head-scratcher for those of us that have covered, and I know you have too, the Natalie Holloway disappearance. It will make you wonder where a committee searching for a candidate to lead the Palm Beach County Convention and Visitors Bureau emerges right from Aruba. Let's talk about this.
Look, all I gotta say is, you know, I covered the Aruba story, and you know, this is the same tourism president, I believe,
yep.
An organization that was putting the fault on Beth Holloway, and of course, Americans, you know, putting pressure on, you know, Americans not, or anyone really for that matter, to go to Aruba to enjoy vacation. And if I'm correct, you know, they were not too friendly towards us or helping. This guy runs the whole tourism industry. He works closely with the hotels, the same hotels that Natalie stayed in and, you know, Beth stayed in and everything. And, you know, I'm sure, to the best of my knowledge, these hotels were not so cooperative with the American media. And I just think it's so ironic that, you know, Palm Beach felt that in the whole United States this was the best person to hire, especially just even if this person was qualified. I just still think they're taking a chance on bringing a high profile Aruban tourism guy to work here at Palm Beach and get tourism going. I just think it's just interesting that they would take that chance on someone here in the States, maybe a media editorial writer, or just people that just have bad views of Aruba because of the whole unfortunate with Natalie Holloway, that they would hire this person. You know what I mean? I think they're opening themselves up to be ripped apart.
I think it's more than interesting. I think it's bizarre. The guy's name is Jorge Pesquera. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and if I'm not, oh well. And they're looking at paying him $198,000 a year. And you're right. Is there not someone in the United States that's more qualified than this guy? Is this not going to be a public relations nightmare for Palm Beach County?
From what I know and been reading, I don't think it has. I just think, until someone wants to start beating the drum, if it's like the Palm Beach newspapers or any newspapers that I'm at in Florida I'm sure heard about this, but there seems to be one person that really hasn't stirred the pot with her opinion. That's, of course, Natalie's mom, who's a great person, Beth. If Beth has no thoughts on this, then, we need someone at that level to be the springboard to observe the story, to say, hey, media, do you know about this? Because the average, again, unless you live in Palm Beach, you read National Wires, not many people probably even know about that this has occurred.
Yeah.
But again, I just think it's very, very interesting that they felt that this is the best guy to bring tourism, to raise it or help the credibility of tourism in Palm Beach.
Yeah, it's bizarre for sure. One quick update before I let you go, Eric. Katie Couric, the bosses at CBS have said she's going to stay doing the news. This is a little follow-up to our story from last week. Your thoughts?
I think they're right in their judgment. I think they hired her not knowing what the outcome was going to be. It hasn't gone in their favor. But, she's a great journalist. And, they have Rick Kaplan is a great EP. And he's a great person, and I just think it takes time. It's just that, unfortunately, the viewers, do they want to see a female? And do they want to stick with the program and see the positive changes? Because, again, I feel if Kitty continues to do those newsmaker stories and they, provide the type of news packages that national viewers want to see, but also, did they know type packages and they're informative, I think they'll do fine. And that's the best you can hope for.
I agree with you. Eric Spinato, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll stay in touch. Bye-bye. Okay, we'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, welcome back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Cole Jackson, age 33, was last seen after leaving a gas station located at 1216 North 1st Street in Timpson, Texas on Friday, July 13th, 2006 at approximately 9 a.m. His truck was found abandoned off a dirt road known as 4042 in Timpson, Texas on July 14th, 2006. He was last seen wearing a brown shirt and blue jeans. It's been a year, and I thought I'd bring on Cheyenne Jackson to talk more about the case. Hi, Cheyenne.
Hello.
It's been a year. There's no easy way to ask these questions, but what's the status of the case, and update us on Cole's disappearance?
Well, basically, we are just as confused as when he first disappeared a year ago. We've had probably two leads of people supposedly claiming they've killed him.
Okay.
And then we've also had two supposedly possible sightings where they say they, swear that they saw him.
Okay, let's start with the two leads of those that have admitted to taking his life. Were they just bogus, or what happened there?
Well, I play it, they're bogus. We had a lady contact my brother because his number is on one of the reward posters that we put up for Cole. And he got a phone call that claimed, that her sister-in-law had told her, about these guys that have told her about putting someone in a vat of acid. And he had a baby not too long afterwards, and he was claimed missing, and, too many things added up. So we brought this lady into the police department, did an interview in front of them, got all the really horrible details, and probably 6 weeks later we contacted them. They still hadn't even ran down a lead. Now, here recently, we did talk to a constable down there, and he did run down one of the people that have claimed verbally to have killed him. But all he did was basically send them on another case saying, no, 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 supposedly Cole stole something from someone, and this guy's after him, but hasn't been seen. So it's just us jumping through hoops and praying. They're just, you know, trying to, I don't know why anybody'd want to do that personally, but
yeah,
attention or what have you, but let's just pray that, you know, they're just full of it.
Exactly, exactly. And there's a lot of nuts out there, and it must be totally frustrating for the family. It sounds like you're not getting quite the cooperation from law enforcement as you should be getting. And for you to have to take in somebody to the police station yourself must be terribly disturbing. What else have you found out?
Well, now, a couple of months back, we did hear of somebody in a little country town that had claimed that they'd seen my brother. They didn't know he was missing, but that a guy fit in his description, of course, a little bit darker, you know, tanned and way skinnier, walked up to him in the woods and said, you know, I really, really hate to ask you this, but is there any possible way I can borrow some gas?
Right.
And evidently he was living out in the woods in a tent or, you know, in his vehicle. It was a green Explorer, kind of a rundown Explorer. And, you know, they felt horrible because this guy's living out there by himself and he's having to ask for gas. They gave him probably $5-$10. And they said probably about 2 or 3 days later, they went into town to a store where we had hung a poster. One of my good friends put up a poster there. And they said, oh, my God, this man is identical to the man we saw a couple days ago. So, of course, you know, they went out there and checked for any kind of campsites. My entire family went out there, scouted all the woods, and couldn't find anything. But supposedly, when they talked to my brother, hopefully my brother, he had claimed that he was about to be leaving to go to Bossier or Shreveport for some work, and had even asked if he could do carpenter work for them. So another possible sighting was a lady in a convenience store where we had hung this poster, said that he came in with one other person and he picked up a package of crackers,
mm-hmm.
put it back, and he walked up to the counter, and the man asked him, you know, would you like a Coke? He said, sure, and supposedly bought him, you know, a 50-cent Coke, and then they left, so they had duck hunting gear on.
Right.
But, you know, more coming that late.
Those sightings, which sound somewhat hopeful, have law enforcement helped you with those?
No.
They haven't. Now, that's the part that it must just be terribly disappointing to you.
Well, you know, supposedly on, you know, the first one, this lady was supposed to be bringing her family in to talk to the cops. So I don't think they moved just in case it was going to endanger her or not. It was the one that they claimed to put them in a vat of acid.
Right.
Now, with, you know, the other sighting, with him being in the woods, you know, I'm not even real clear or real sure if we even told law enforcement. It was a friend of ours that contacted us, said, look, he might be out here, and my dad and brother just took off and got out there.
Right.
Just for the fact that, you know, they're trying to say, even though he's got misdemeanors, but, you know, for some reason, I don't know, they're trying to say, you know, even if he comes back, he'll get in trouble because he's been missing this long. So before we even turned it over to them, we just wanted to go check it out, see if there's anything of it. And there wasn't.
Well, and the important thing is finding your brother. Dealing with the other problems is minor compared to this.
Right.
Have the news media been helping you?
Well, in the beginning, I basically have had to take over all the media coverage. I contacted all the newspapers, all the news channels. A few of them aired it in the beginning. I have since been, you know, just trying to keep them in the story. At first, they wouldn't repeat the coverage because there was no update.
Right.
Well, that's part of the frustrating and, you know, mysterious thing about it is there is no update. There is no more answers. We do need to keep this out there. And, you know, basically, without me giving them anything extra, they didn't want to do it. So, you know, since then, I've went on air, and I've did a couple of TV interviews with some Tyler stations and Longview stations, and I've done phone recordings with the Nacogdoches stations to just try to, you know, give him something to keep his face and to keep his name out there so people can help us look for him.
Cheyenne, where can people learn more about your missing brother, Cole Jackson?
If you want to visit his MySpace, it's www.myspace.com/ColeJackson33.
And if they have information?
They can message me there, or you can even message me at my email address. It's cheyandcody@yahoo.com. Anonymous if they need to. I just want to find my brother.
And we'll have information here at Scared Monkeys at scaredmonkeys.com. Thank you, Cheyenne, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks to all my guests this evening for joining me on the program. This is Dana Pretzer on Scared Monkeys Radio signing off until next week. Remember, you can pick up podcasts of this program and my daily commentary at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. This show will be available a little bit later on tonight or early tomorrow morning. Thank you all, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Good night.